Chapter 13. Tendrils of Lothian Chaos. The halfling Wigglefingers found the man in an alley beside a tavern, one of five predetermined meeting spots for this most particular spy.
"My payment, wizard," the man said upon his approach.
He was not tall for a human, but towered over the halfling spellcaster. Wigglefingers sighed and tried to hide his disgust.
"Do you not even care about the consequences of this most urgent information?"
The man, Artemis Intrary, seemed genuinely amused by that.
"I thought you cared for Jarlaxle, for Driz Dowerden even,"
the exasperated halfling added. How he wanted to create some great magical cataclysm and wash this fool away. The man shrugged and gave a little nod.
"Yet you ask for payment straight away."
"Of course," said Intrary. "Dahlia and I have decided that we should find a better housing arrangement. For that I need the payment."
"And if I didn't have it?"
"You wouldn't be here."
No, put that aside," said Wigglefingers. "Suppose I found you here this day, desperate for the news but unprepared to pay you. Would you tell me the information, that I could relate it to Jarlaxle and Lady Danala, or would you sit quiet and let others suffer?"
"Perhaps some day you will find out."
"I grow tired of your games."
"Then take a nap. In the meantime, remember, this isn't a game. I do a job, I get paid." The halfling could only sigh and even chuckle a bit. He didn't believe that this one was as irascible as he pretended, and he had fully soured on the man's dangerous reputation. There were plenty of capable halfling scouts working Waterdeep streets, and yet Lady Danala had specifically instructed the wizard to visit this human. Which bothered him even more, because Intrary was Jarlaxle's man and not Danala's. That knowledge didn't help Wigglefinger's mood very much either. Anything that he garnered from this rogue would almost certainly be given to Jarlaxle long before Danala heard it, and cleared by Jarlaxle, the halfling wizard assumed. He couldn't deny Intrary's reputation as a spy, as Jarlaxle considered the man one of his very top lieutenants, and surely the human knew his way with sword and dagger. But this was the northern sword coast of Faerun, a region called the Savage Frontier, and swordsmen were a crowd a copper. The notion that this one, above all the others, could get the job done deeply insulted the fiercely proud halfling, who had, after all, personally trained most of Danala's younger scouts. Yet here he stood, disgusted by how much he needed what Intrary had for him. Wigglefingers reminded himself that it was not his place to question, not then. He produced a small pouch of gems and handed them over. Surprisingly, Intrary didn't even look inside. Only then did it dawn on Wigglefingers.
The man figures he doesn't have to because he assumes no one would dare short him on such a payment.
Such hubris was almost enough to make the wizard laugh. Or cry in frustration, especially when Intrary said nothing.
"The Stoneshaft clan bought Thornhold from Lord Neverember,"
Wigglefingers prompted.
"And Lord Neverember had previously purchased the castle from House Margaster, we believe."
"Just last year," Intrary confirmed, "for 40,000 pieces of gold."
40,000? "That is a paltry sum. It makes no sense."
Intrary shrugged.
"And only last year?"
"Last summer," Intrary answered.
"But why?"
the wizard muttered, more to himself than to Intrary, cupping his chin in his hand and staring at the floor. He looked back up at Intrary a moment later.
"We need you to look more deeply. How long did the Margasters own Thornhold before the transaction with Lord Neverember? And why would they sell to him at so low a price? Did they not know of the dwarves' interest?"
"Should I deliver the Lord of House Margaster to Lady Danala in chains, so that she can spend a decade interrogating him?" came the predictably sarcastic response.
"Just those three simple questions," Wigglefingers replied. "Oh, and a fourth. Are the Margasters not angered at Lord Neverember's apparent windfall? 40,000 gold, you say? We believe that Neverember garnered 25 times that value."
Intrary didn't even blink. "And you ask me to care about these games, as if the lives of my friends depend upon them?" he said after a long pause. "For Neverember and all the others, this is more about stature than value. 1,000,000 gold? What will Neverember do with that sum that he could not already do?
bury it under a castle while people around him starve or freeze in the dark of winter? And you ask me to care?
But you care about your payment, the halfling pointed out.
I like to eat, and prefer to respectably buy my food instead of hurting people to get it. That silenced the halfling. 4 questions, and Trary agreed. But it may take some time. A lot of good men could die giving this information. Wigglefingers nodded, but then scrunched up his face as he considered the odd phrasing.
You mean, getting?
And then Wigglefingers saw it, that particularly cold look. And so the assassin's eyes told the wizard that he had not misspoken. In that terrible moment, Wigglefingers feared that he might someday be one of the necessary victims to whom Artemis and Trary had just referred. The halfling left the meeting almost immediately, taking with him valuable information about the Margasters and Lord Neverember for Denala, and perhaps even more information for himself about the true danger of this strange human. Indeed, the assassin's stare would linger with the wizard for a long time after he discharged his newly bought intelligence. A single candle burned on the table between Denala Topolino, Wigglefingers, and Jarlaxle, a fittingly quiet light for a discussion that had to be whispered.
Regis thinks the price near to 1,000,000 pieces of gold,
Denala confirmed. A treasure King Brunner would be hard-pressed to muster, said a curious Jarlaxle. Yet this Stoneshaft clan, hardly known.
I told you it was intriguing,
Denala replied with a soft laugh. You said a bit intriguing, if I recall. It is more than that, it would seem.
More still, said Denala.
She looked to Wigglefingers.
Your agent in Waterdeep told me that Lord Neverember purchased the stronghold only a short while before from House Margaster, for a fraction of the price to the dwarves. But of course, I expect you already know this.
If Jarlaxle took umbrage at Wigglefingers' accusation, he didn't show it. Instead, he just sat back in his chair, tap-tapping his long, slender fingers together, digesting it all, assembling the pieces of the puzzle. The wizard continued.
Many of Margaster's nobles were there in Neverwinter, in Neverember's own court, when the dwarves arrived with their payment, and we've reason to believe that another of the Margasters may well have ridden north to meet the dwarven caravan on their way to Neverwinter.
Their roundabout way, Jarlaxle said. And the other two perked up, for Jarlaxle typically accepted more information than he ever offered. The dwarves sailed around Neverwinter to the north, to port last, as you suspected, the drow mercenary confirmed. There they disembarked, and the ships sailed away in the night, and the dwarves marched south straight from the docks with no announcement and little fanfare.
It could not have been easy to arrange that, Wigglefingers reasoned.
Even less than you would believe, said Jarlaxle. The folk of Port Last are often besieged. To bring a heavily armed dwarven force of that magnitude through the city in the dark of night surely meant more than a few bags of gold sliding into the right pockets.
We know they had the gold, Denala said dryly. It would take more than just gold, though, wouldn't it?
Asked the halfling wizard. Jarlaxle offered a slight nod, but no words, as he sat back in contemplation, tapping his fingertips. Why weren't the Margasters upset about Neverember's apparently huge windfall on a property they had only recently sold to him? They were there in the court. Regis had seen them, and they're in great numbers in the inn, according to Denala. This was no happy face they were painting on for optics, Jarlaxle believed. They were truly glad for the sale. The term money-washing ran through his mind, just as it surely did through the minds of his rather worldly associates at this table. Certainly Denala and the wizard had seen their share of this back in Aglarond. It was a favored game to secretly tip the scales of power until unwitting rivals could do nothing to preserve the current order. Lord Neverember had bought low from the Margasters, who probably didn't even actually hold the deed to the place. House Margaster then funneled a vast treasure to the little-known, little-cared-about clan Stoneshaft,
who delivered it to Lord Neverember under the guise of repatriating themselves to a fortress they once considered their home, to great fanfare and celebration. As sure as an annoying elf launching into inane song, everyone knew that dwarves would always go to great lengths to regain lost homelands. And of course, Clan Stoneshaft had likely been in possession of, probably even living under, this place called Thornhold the whole time. The entire purpose of the transaction, then, was simply to wash ill-gotten gold and get it out of Waterdeep.
"And now the newest twist," Dinala said,
after all three had mulled in silence for a long while.
"House Margaster is, perhaps, much more than it appears. Much more sinister."
The door cracked open, and a halfling attendant poked his head in.
"Milady," he said, "your husband."
The attendant pulled the door wide, and a shaky Regis entered.
"You should be in bed,"
Dinala said, standing and starting for him. But Regis held her back with an outstretched arm.
"We'll all rest when this is done," he said,
taking a seat at the table. He gave a great exhale as he sat, clearly exhausted and overwhelmed.
"Trust me that I am glad I am alive to sit here and join this meeting. All because of good fortune and good friends," he added, looking to Jarlaxle. "You dismiss your own cleverness in getting out of those tunnels?"
Dinala asked.
"I already said good fortune," said Regis. "I am luckily more at home in the water, nay, under the water, than a halfling ought to be."
"Whatever the reason," said Jarlaxle, lifting a goblet of wine, "we are glad of the outcome."
"And doubting my story, I expect," said Regis. "As am I." "Iberdell's was identical, though," said Wigglefingers.
Regis gave the wizard an appreciative nod, and was glad that the information had come from him, whom Regis thought the least supportive of the three.
"Now we must discern what lives under Lord Neverember's castle, and in Neverwinter Wood, it would seem,"
Dinala said. "That forest is no stranger to creatures of the lower plains," Jarlaxle told them.
"The Ashmedai?"
Dinala asked.
"I thought they were gone."
"Such cults are rarely ever gone," the drow replied. "Dark dandelions, one and all, and my sources whisper that Asmodeus has gained a fair number of followers in Waterdeep."
"Asmodeus is an arch-devil," Regis interrupted. "These were demons, not devils."
"How do you know?" Jarlaxle asked.
"We just stepped this dance in the Bloodstone Lands," Regis reminded. "Trust me. I watched the Lady in Kerry transform before my eyes into a Glabrezu, a demon I have known before."
"I do not doubt you, my friend," Jarlaxle said, as the same attendant to Dinala poked his head into the room again. "But a devil could do the same, and many resemble." "No devil," said another drow, pushing into the room, walking with a limp, his left arm held tight to his side. "Glabrezu." Jarlaxle leaped from his seat and rushed to help his wounded soldier. Dinala called to the attendant to fetch a proper priest. "I will survive," Braylon Jonquet assured them, nevertheless taking Jarlaxle's offered seat. "Glabrezu?" Jarlaxle asked him. Braylon nodded. "And Casmes and others. Demons all. A remarkable collection, thick about Neverwinter Wood, but coming from the city itself in pursuit of Regis, I would guess." He turned and winked at Regis. "This is twice now that you owe me your life, halfling. Perhaps Jarlaxle would be wise in extracting my pay from your pocket."
"Twice?"
"The woman with the bow on the lake bank in Icewind Dale," Braylon explained. "Did you think your own shot so lucky?" Regis's lips moved too fast for any actual words to spill out for a short while, before finally managing to blurt,
"That was you?"
Braylon managed a little laugh, followed by a blood-filled cough.
"Is there anything in the north that Jarlaxle does not watch?"
Regis asked, his voice heavy with sarcasm. "Not if I can help it," Jarlaxle replied, rubbing Braylon's back and trying to ease the wounded soldier's obvious discomfort. Fortunately, a pair of clerics, halfling and dwarf, bumbled into the room then, holy symbols in hand. Jarlaxle stepped back as they went to work on Braylon. Confident that the drow's wounds were not mortal, he let his mind go to the matters at hand. He didn't doubt the veracity of the reports from Regis and Braylon,
The rise of supporters for Asmodeus in Waterdeep, after all, had come about because so many more demons had been showing up all across Faerun of late. Some foolish humans, desperate and afraid, had come to believe that allying with the lawful devils was somehow better than risking the dangers of the unpredictable demons. There was some truth to that, Jarlaxle had to admit, but only in certain circumstances. Devils were more predictable than demons, which generally were little more than vile killing machines, with less subtlety than a trebuchet throwing baskets of fire into a village. The catch was that getting a devil out of your midst, especially one to which you owed a favor, was never an easy or inexpensive task. But Waterdeep was a worry for another day. The more immediate challenge involved the Lord Protector of Neverwinter and his strange partners in crime. Demons, he whispered under his breath to focus his thinking. And he suspected then that the source of these unwelcome visitors along the Sword Coast might well be the same as the ones who brought Malkinthet, the Queen of the Succubi, to the Bloodstone Lands not so long ago. He needed some information, and fast, and he had an idea of who might be best able to get it for him.
"So good to be back in lands I've never seen,"
Amber Grisolo Maul remarked, skipping down the road, her huge two-handed mace, Skull Crusher, resting on her shoulder.
"If ye ain't been in 'em there, then how are ye back in 'em, eh?"
teased her companion, her lover, her best friend, Athrogate. The thick-limbed fellow had found some fresh cow pies that morning to better braid and tip his huge black beard, and Amber found the aroma intoxicating.
"I know some place you're not soon getting back into, me clever hubby."
Athrogate gave a great harumph at that, though he was hardly unaccustomed to that line from Amber, and knew that his amorous companion never meant it, or couldn't hold to it if she did.
"Your legs getting tired yet?" Athrogate asked. "I can bring out me pig."
He grabbed at his belt pouch, in which sat the figurine he used to summon a magical hellbore.
"I can always bring out the pig in ye,"
Amber remarked, unable to resist.
"But no, me love, let's walk and skip and dance in the day. Oh, but a beautiful one she is."
Amber looked all about at the sky, bright blue and dotted with puffy white clouds, but Athrogate just stared admiringly at her as he replied,
"Ah, but sure'n she is."
They walked for the rest of the morning, talking lightly, enjoying the day, anticipating that they'd be back in Bleeding Vine soon enough, for they had left the place far behind. The day was warm for the season, but winter held, and so the caravans had not yet begun their spring travels, giving the dwarven pair the road to themselves. Better still, they were moving back near the coastline now, as they had nearly circumvented the Mirror of Dead Men, and so the smell of bog was being quickly replaced by the refreshing aroma of salt and brine. When looking for a place to break for some lunch, they happened upon a road turning west off the tradeway. And following it to the next rise, they soon came in sight of the ocean, and more importantly, a plain gray fortress with a squat central keep flanked by two towers. Amber took out the rough drawing Jarlaxle had made for her and nodded to Athrogate.
"Thornhold," she said. "A million pieces of gold ain't buying what it used to,"
Athrogate lamented, for indeed, the fort was not overly impressive, nor strategically located.
"Well, good enough for them stone shafts, then. Let's go see what we can see. I'm thinking they got the money for a proper feast."
They clambered down over the broken rocks to what seemed to be an entry road, though one long reduced to tangled vines and rubble. Before them loomed the fortress's main gate, a pair of gigantic, iron-banded wooden doors that looked as if they could once have held back a horde of giants. Once, but not now, for they hung a kilter, one missing its top hinges, which left it angled, creating an opening wide enough for a dwarf to walk through without bending, as was proven even as Athrogate noted it, when a yellow-haired dwarf walked out and stepped to the side. He crossed his burly arms over his chest, shield presented in the top one, mace held high in the other. Up above, more dwarves peered over the wall.
"Clan Stoneshaft, I'm guessing," Athrogate told his love.
"Aye, and an ugly-looking bunch, what?"
Ambergris replied. A second dwarf came out, then a third and fourth, forming a line and stepping forward toward the oncoming pair as more filtered out behind them.
"Well met," Athrogate called to them, waving and scrambling over the last rock before the entry path, which leveled out somewhat.
He reached back to help Amber over the stone, but she just hopped it and rolled, planting her huge two-handed mace as she went to prop her right to her feet.
"Aye, well met, and we're looking for some food," she called, moving right past Athrogate. "And glad to see dwarfs here in this unknown place, aye."
"Well, who'd ye expect, then?"
asked one from behind the line of four dwarves, stepping up between them. He was a strong one, certainly, with yellow hair tightened into cornrows and a great beard that rivaled Athrogate's own. From the description Jarlaxle had offered, Athrogate figured this one to be Bronkin, the commander of the force that had gone to Lord Neverember's castle.
"Weren't knowing," Athrogate said before Amber could respond. "Been walking a long way and not knowing what to expect. Too far south for that new Delzoon home, aye, and not north enough yet for Icewind Dale." "New Delzoon home?" the yellow-haired dwarf asked, coming forward along with a dozen of his compatriots, all moving out and around to fully flank the incoming couple. "You're meaning Gontalgrim, then, or this home you're now seeing?"
"Gontalgrim, aye," Athrogate answered. "Not knowing this one you're speaking of, but eh, are ye Delzoon dwarf now, or ain't ye? And if not?"
"Think all dwarfs in the north where that blood is all," said Athrogate.
"Might we are, might we ain't."
Athrogate shrugged as if it didn't matter, though the line of answer surely seemed inappropriate and surprising to him. The Delzoon heritage had represented the great north kingdom of the dwarves for centuries, and almost all dwarves in the north of Faerûn now identified with the name, or at least showed some measure of reverence for it.
"Might ye are, might ye ain't, then," said Amber. "But sure in that we're glad to see ye, whate'er. For I've a mighty thirst and a grumbling tummy, and a dwarf's a dwarf if he's not a grey one, eh?"
"Eh,"
answered the stone shaft leader, though he didn't sound convinced.
"So what are we eating, then?" Amber pressed.
"Nothing's on the spit."
The flatness of his tone spoke of a threat.
"So put something on," Athrogate said. "You're not turning kin aside, are ye?"
"What kin?"
another stone shaft said.
"Kin of Brunner, not for Dalton,"
added a third, and she spat on the ground.
"Ye got a problem with King Brunner, do ye?" Amber asked. "And what might that be, then? He's got Gontalgrim back from the ruins and running strong."
"Aye, if there's a problem with that, then might that ye'll be telling us, eh?"
Athrogate added.
"We be looking for him and the place, and hoping it's worth the journey. What ain't we knowing?" "Brunner got no friends here,"
the one Athrogate believed to be Bronkin flatly stated.
"Friends of Brunner got no friends here."
"Who ye be, then?" asked Amber. "And what's this place? A better stop for weary dwarfs?"
"Ain't that," one of the stone shafts muttered.
Both Amber and Athrogate looked in the direction of the mutterer, then back at the leader, who merely shrugged, not disagreeing with the assessment.
"You're telling us to be leaving, then," Athrogate said.
"Said no such thing,"
answered the leader.
"He'll be running right to Brunner," said another.
"Who'd be back with an army, as all must kneel or die," said yet another.
"Aye, but he's the king of all, don't you know," said another.
And while they were talking, they fanned out even more, nearly closing the circle around the couple.
"You're not showing much kinship, mate," Amber told the leader. "You didn't even ask our names or offer your own."
"Her name's Amber and his is Athrogate," a dwarf on the wall called. "Brunner's spies."
"Worse,"
said a dwarf to the side of the couple, pulling a battle axe from his back and resting it on one shoulder.
"These two are spies for the derned drow elves."
Athrogate tried hard to keep his jaw from dropping open. How could they know any of that? How could they know more about Jarlaxle than Jarlaxle knew of them? It never worked that way. But now he and Amber had no choice, and while she brought Skullcrusher out before her, Athrogate pulled his flails from over his shoulders, setting the balls to spinning immediately.
"We didn't come looking for trouble," he told the leader. "Funny what ye find."
"Just wondering of the new unannounced neighbors," Amber added. "Any dwarf would understand that."
The ring began to close around them, stone shaft weapons at the ready.
"You're making a mistake, boys," Athrogate warned.
Even as he finished, a dwarf wielding a shield and mace leaped at him, pulling in or trying to, for Athrogate called to his flail whacker, summoning a coating of special oil that exploded when he brought the ball swinging against that shield, splintering the buckler into a dozen flying shards and launching the dwarf back a dozen strides. He feared he had killed the poor fellow, but what else could he do? The other stone shafts came in a fast couple of strides, but fell back in unison, short of the swipe of Amber's murderous two-handed mace.
"Yourself and meself," Athrogate challenged the leader. "Or be Brunken stone shaft a coward?"
The others laughed at that, but those laughs sounded strange somehow. Brunken just smiled and nodded.
"I'll be liking that."
But he didn't come on. He nodded left and right, and the 10 remaining stone shafts on the perimeter all threw their weapons to the ground. At first it seemed as if they were giving up, but then they leaped as one high into the air toward the couple. Not leaping, actually, but diving as if into a pool of water. And they hit the ground and sank into it, disappearing like otters into a lake.
"The Nine Hells,"
Athrogate stammered, and the ground all about him and Amber began to bubble and ooze with some black tar-like liquid. From that liquid, the stone shaft dwarves returned, but not as dwarves. 10 black tendrils rose up around Athrogate and Ambergris, their tips ending in claws, their sides lined with suckers, like the arms of an octopus. Athrogate went into a wild spin, batting at the nearby tendrils. Ambergris, too, tried to fight them off, though less successfully with her single heavy weapon. She did bat one, sending it rolling out the other way, but a second whipped her from behind, cracking her along the back and sending her sprawling. Or she would have been sprawling except that the hook and top suckers caught her and brought her right back to her feet, then up into the air, swirling her all about before bringing her down again with tremendous force. Athrogate heard her heavy grunt amid the slaps of his spinning flails as she kissed the stone. Furiously, he pressed toward her, whacking with abandon. Up went Amber again, her face all bloody, but this time she spun around and grabbed at the tendril with her arms and with her teeth, and to great effect, it seemed, from the way the arm began thrashing about. Athrogate rolled under the crack of a snapping claw and came to his feet to see the leader laughing and pointing. He glanced at his love and knew he had to trust in her. Out he charged, smacking aside the grabbing arms. One caught him, wrapping around his waist, but the tough dwarf turned with it, rolling to loop the thing tighter like a rabbit rolling into the python, except that this rabbit possessed the strength of a storm giant, and he clamped his arms about the tendril, rolled in even more, then tugged with all his strength. A piercing shriek erupted from somewhere as the tendril began to tear from the ground. Other tendrils snapped at the dwarf, but he roared and ignored them and drove on, ripping out the grasping arm. The tendril went limp, its coils falling off him, and as soon as it hit the ground, twitching in death throes, it reverted and became again a dwarf, albeit a broken and dying one, spitting black blood. Athrogate's eyes widened in horror. What was this madness? He spied the dwarf leader staring back at him hatefully now. He was no longer laughing. Brunken motioned to a dwarf beside him who tapped a pendant hanging around his neck. It flared with an inner black glow, and the dwarf flared too, growing suddenly, sprouting extra arms, his hair becoming fur, his dwarven face becoming that of a dog demon.
"Mystery solved," Athrogate roared, and he charged at the Glabrezu, shouldering aside another writhing tentacle, whacking yet another. "Come on, Ambergris, my girl!"
Athrogate almost got to the waiting four-armed demon, but with surprising coordination and apparently at a command from the watching Brunken, two tentacles reached out at him, coming in low, wrapping his ankles and dropping him hard to his face. The dwarf's first instinct was to grab at a stone, but his rage got the better of him and he turned at the tentacles instead, thinking to splatter them, for Whacker had another coating of oil of impact ready. Before he could begin his swing, though, Athrogate rose up suddenly into the air, circling right over as the tentacles moved in unison to bring him crashing down into the black goo and hard stones beneath. He bounced once, felt his flails go flying, and then he was flying, hoisted straight back up, only this time the tentacles let him go. High into the air, Athrogate soared, spinning willy-nilly. He called for his love, then saw her, suspended in the air, spread-armed and spread-legged, held at each wrist and ankle by a tugging tendril. And there beside her stood the Glabrezu, looking back at Athrogate and smiling wickedly, so wickedly, its pincer clamped about poor, helpless Amber's waist, cutting, so slowly,
He had to get to her. That was his only thought, his last thought, as he slammed into the ground once again, and knew no more.
Zachnephane was glad for the work, glad to be back on the road of adventure once more, especially an adventure that might offer him the chance to kill a drow priestess, which had always been a pleasure for him, and glad, most of all, to be away from a situation he could not comprehend or properly digest. He had listened to the tales of the human woman and his son, and he could not deny that within them he had found some comfort and hope. But he could not bring himself to accept a human as his daughter-in-law and her child, a half-breed. He took the notion away and focused on his mission. He was grateful to Jarlaxle for trusting him with this. He looked back at the two dark elves trailing him, Braylon Jonquet and Jayrel Fay, one of the few women in Bregendyearth and a priestess of some goddess who was, remarkably, not Loth. Zachnephane had asked the beautiful amber-eyed drow for some details regarding her deity, but she had just scowled at him and told him to take the point position as Jarlaxle had instructed. That had only made Zachnephane more attracted to her. But that wasn't really all that surprising, as a drow woman with the courage to take her clerical skills to a goddess other than the Spider Queen was about as attractive as anything to Zachnephane. He was at the point now, 20 strides ahead of his companions, walking the tunnels of the upper Underdark, and so he reminded himself that he should be concentrating on the winding passage before him, and not the companions behind.
Question: how does one find a drow? He asked under his breath, and he smiled at the long-ago conversation he had exchanged with Jarlaxle in tunnels much deeper than these.
Zachnephane considered the answer. He had found those centuries before in Menzo Berenzon, but he didn't have any halfling captives with him this time, and was glad of that. Jarlaxle had assured him that things would be taken care of.
"How indeed," he whispered, and on he went.